Welcome to Cooking Rice, a series of interviews with people who are as deeply engaged in social transformation as they are in their own personal journeys. Cooking rice is taken from an ancient Asian proverb, well-loved and used by Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, to express his commitment and his social vision that inner knowing or wisdom alone is insufficient. Only when joined with transformative engagement with the world does the rice actually get cooked. This is your host, Marty Janowitz. In this episode, I had the opportunity to speak with Michael Scott, who I call the unlikely businessman. He evolved from a traveling photographer and spiritual seeker who was inspired, nudged, or perhaps directed by Chogyam Trungpa, and now finds himself a successful and admired business person, social entrepreneur, and mentor. Well, Michael, we were talking just before the conversation started about how when I first encountered you, you were probably one of the furthest people from being a businessman among the many people I knew who were far from being a businessman. So say a little bit about how you found yourself moving from the world as it was when you encountered the Dharma and Chogyam Trungpa to where you find yourself today.
Mm. I never visualized myself as a business person. I was brought up in a family where education and the arts were predominant and important in people's lives, and I met Rinpoche originally in Scotland, and I think at that time certainly business wasn't part of it. It was a connection with him and with some very rudimentary understanding of Dharma. And then several years later, when I happened to visit him in the U.S. and then subsequently decided to move to the U.S. from England, when I needed to figure out how I was going to make a living. So it was a question of livelihood, really, as much as anything. And I didn't have credentials that were going to be mean anything in the U.S., and what was I going to do? And I wanted to be in Boulder, and I had met my wife. And Rinpoche proposed the idea of perhaps I could do something in business. And that was a very bizarre idea to me, but through various circumstances, I did get into a business, which was actually in the gemstone business, which I knew nothing about. But I learned, and the thing that interested me about it quite early on was the fact that it was a combination of the quality of relationships between people, understanding what their needs and wants were, and making things work so that they would work for each party. So I think those were interesting aspects to me that I encountered early on in business.
Yeah, I had managed to temporarily obliterate from my memory anything to do with your being in the gemstone business, as I have done generally with the gemstone business that I was also part of. That was hardly a model of a wonderful business performance. You must have had some interesting experiences.
That's true, but I think that the thing that spoke to me through things that were not so easy in that whole process was the fact that it's about relationship. Hmm. It's about relationship, and finding ways that satisfy all the parties. That came home to me, despite any ripples that came about with that particular business. And so I carried that forward as over the years, and as I became involved with other kinds of business, unrelated. But there's still those threads were there. It's about people.
I recall when I first met you, always thinking of you with a camera around your neck,
right?
Continually. In fact, I thought of you as a photographer. Did you explore taking advantage of something you already knew how to do as a livelihood?
I did, and in a small way, I did actually make a bit of a living doing that, but it was a bit iffy. I didn't think that it was really going to be very substantial, and It was fine as a sort of a sideline.
You could have been a major wedding photographer by now.
Exactly.
Well,
It didn't grab me as a livelihood. It grabbed me as an activity.
Interesting. Now, were you involved in connecting with other people at that time who were getting involved with business? I remember there was a Ratna Society, a Jewel Society,
yeah,
as it were.
Yeah, the Ratna Society was actually very influential for me, and it was, this is something that Rinpoche had led, initiated, and spoken at, and he talked about business from the point of view of natural wealth, actually, in particular, I remember. So to get away from the idea that, you know, of a lack of resources and, you know, grabbing what you can kind of thing, to enriching the environment and looking upon the environment as being basically enriched, and, you know, about a plethora of resources. And so that whole idea as to how you could manifest in the business environment came through from then too.
I'll mention parenthetically that Ratna Society was taken from the term for jewel, which was a symbol of richness in the Buddhist tradition, and Rinpoche gave that name to a group of people he was bringing together as proto-business people.
Mm-hmm.
Good. So over the years, did you find once a Triple Gem, the gem company, didn't succeed, that you just continued along in business?
Yeah. I had an opportunity with another friend in the community, actually, who was looking for somebody to work with him on uncovering possibilities. This was with Michael Chendo. He had a mandate from a New York-based company to look for opportunities in minerals exploration opportunities in the Western U.S. And he needed somebody to help. And he and I struck up a really good relationship and discussion on it, and I joined him. And that led to other things from the parent company that was funding this, and I wound up the business manager of a metals extraction plant because I was the guy at the time who could do it. And, you know, and so it sort of grew organically there from one situation to the next. But each time it was more complex and more interesting.
As you were pursuing this career now as a business person, were you thinking of it more as a way to support your Dharma activity, or was it more closely part of your Dharmic practice activity?
That's a great question. I think initially it was probably to pursue. It was a means to an end. But as time went on, it became much more an embodiment of it, because, well, and the things that we were learning from Rinpoche about, you know, connecting understanding of Dharma into the everyday world. So there I was doing these things, and I tried to find ways to do that. And really, it was how to work with people. And Rinpoche was very clear about that, you know, to pay attention to the people in a business relationship as much as any other. So yes, it became part of practice.
It must have, from time to time, also gotten in the way of doing some of the things you might have desire to do in practice.
Yes, it did, but it was enough of it. It had its own sort of richness and life. It didn't feel like a sacrifice to miss doing some things because of doing that, because it really had a lot that I was learning from it, and a lot of penetration for me and into situations. So I didn't feel it was a sacrifice, actually.
And over time, it also sounds like you were an entrepreneur as much as a business, just a business person, building businesses or working in businesses?
Yeah, mostly more businesses. Well, I was not very familiar with big corporate environments, and I didn't have the background for that. So I was involved in some early stage enterprises before I moved to Canada, actually. You know, again, it was sort of, what are the components between money, financing, the intellectual property? I was involved in an early stage company that was a biotech company, actually, that started up in the 1984 kind of era. And So it was, again, it was how to put pieces together to create something meaningful, something useful. So I guess that's entrepreneurial. I don't think it was a, I didn't think of myself as an entrepreneur so much as a gluer, a glue person, gluing things together that made sense.
From the perspective of the so-called conventional world, or the conventional world of people who study spirituality, they might typically think, well, business, pshaw. I mean, that's the bad world. That's associated with all the bad things that happen. I mean, do you find yourself torn anyway about being in business?
Not at all. Absolutely not at all. And I think that is really due to Rinpoche's encouragement, obviously, of us all together and things like the Ratna Society that you mentioned, and his promotion, almost, that's not quite the word, but his support of the idea that business can be sane and business does not have to be about ripping people off or sneakiness or lies and, and cheating. I mean, he absolutely, he said that how many times to all of us, but also he gave me very personal, strong encouragement to stay in that world. So I regarded it completely as the place that I wanted to be, not the place that was, when I get done with this at 5 o'clock, I can go and do my Dharma practice.
Have you ever found yourself in situations where the temptations that come from the world of business materialism have either closely or sucked you into the abyss?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, there have been some things where I felt, you have an opportunity to get something a little extra that really, isn't quite yours, that kind of thing. Many years ago, I remember having a couple of experiences like that, and they felt not good. And so I said, okay, well, that's an interesting one. And it was about fairness, actually. So basically about respect and fairness. And as soon as you cross the line for what I want at the exclusion of what is appropriate for the circumstance, then you feel bad and it doesn't work. And so I learned that and I stopped doing it many years ago, I think.
Well, one of the things that I've come to think I understand along that line is that each one of the things which have been incorporated as basic building blocks of the world of materialism and the world of suffering are mostly inherently neutral. It's almost as if they've been subjugated by the forces of negativity, everything from militarism to business. And that one of the messages we inherited was that unless we can take those forms and reconquer them for a different benefit, the world will never actually change. Does that make any sense to you?
Absolutely. And Rinpoche's lead on that, and the way he did that with so many activities, and obviously with his relationship with the Kosung, and the meaning of a military is a, truly a force of good and peace and generosity, was pretty revolutionary. So he did that in that realm, he did it in other realms, and he did it in my mind vis-a-vis business. And so, when I came to move to Nova Scotia and start to look to what I would do here, the idea of generosity in business was very much embedded in my thinking. And generosity, not like giving away the farm, but generosity really of relationship and how and the opportunity that you can provide for people was very much out of his approach and things that he taught.
Following that logic to its end, or halfway to its end, if there were a society that exemplified what a society would be like if it was built and was allegiant to the principles we would associate with a good practice Dharma society, would there be Walmart in that society? You didn't think I was going to ask you easy questions.
No. Probably not, actually. And the reason not is because I think there's advantage being taken at the front end in terms of supply and pressure on supply. But there are a lot of things that would exist, and I certainly think that the business that we're doing, that I run, I feel is completely compatible with, you know, an enlightened view of the world. It's a helping business. It's providing products that are helping patients in hospitals and so forth. So, you know, really it's a question of service. You know, I think if you look upon business as service, not only to your customers and, you know, the people who are benefiting that way, but also for the people who are working in the business, so that it's a source of opportunity.
Let's talk a little bit about your business, which we haven't really gotten into, and then we can talk about how you got into it. I think of your business as the technical goop business, and I'm sure that's an accurate representation in all dimensions. So why don't you describe what your business, what Precision Biologic is and does?
Okay, the simple sort of short paragraph version is that we develop and we manufacture and we sell products that are used mostly in hospital laboratories, and they're used for testing of coagulation disorders, blood coagulation disorders.
So I was right, technical goop, yes.
Yeah. And, you know, these are tests that are done in hospitals all around the world. And if somebody has a bleeding problem or a potential danger of forming blood clots and so forth, there is something going on in their system that needs to be addressed, something a little bit out of whack. And our products are used to diagnose what those problems are. So it's quite specialized and also global. It happens. These products are used in one way or another around the world.
Now, you didn't wake up one day and decide the business I have the natural passion for is the technical hospital testing laboratory business. Just I once asked my dad, who designed girdles and bras for a living, and how we got into that, and it was kind of like, well, somebody's got to do it. So I also asked, what is it, Dad? And he said, well, one year you put a ribbon on, next year you take a ribbon off. But in your case, what was the path,
right,
getting from the gem business to the laboratory business?
Okay, well, I had had several years in before I moved to Canada, involved with a startup company that was in the biotech field, not in this field, but in biotech, and I got to know a little bit about how the dynamics of that industry work, including raising money and so forth. And when I moved here, there was a company here that was a very small company of less than 10 people that had developed products in this particular field that we are now in to this day. And the founder of the company was having difficulty figuring how to grow the business. He was looking for investors. Myself and a partner, somebody in the community, Andy Carr, looked and said, you know, we know a little bit about goop, not so much maybe, but maybe we could give it a crack and we'll put some money in, along with some other local investors, and see if we can help this thing move forward. It was very important to us, actually, that we do this with local investors, because part of what we wanted to do was to understand how things work here. It was a very different environment in Nova Scotia than in Colorado in many ways, and so we didn't want to be going out on a limb on our own, but there were some other people involved that were local, and we thought, okay, we'll join in with that, and we'll see if we can do some good. And to cut a long story short, it didn't work very well, the plan that the founder of the company had. And things the company was not going forward as we all had hoped, and was losing money. And we said, we need to do something different. So we actually went through a process of rethinking what the business could be about. And we basically turned it around. So it was a happenstance angel investment leading to not good outcome, requiring a turnaround, and that's where I got involved. How can we turn this around?
Did you ever find yourself waking up in the morning saying you were, no pun intended, stuck in this business?
We hadn't put enough money in to feel stuck. We were ready to say, if this doesn't work, forget about it. And Andy was wonderful about that because his attitude was basically, look, we're going to get our money's worth out of this one way or the other. Either we're going to learn something or we're going to make it work. And either outcome is fine. And that's what we did. So, no, didn't feel stuck in it. It was like, we gave ourselves a fairly short leash, put a little more money in, and let's give it a roll. And it was an adventure. At that point, it was an adventure. It was like, totally, let's just see. And if it all collapses in a heap within a year, fine. But we're going to experiment.
And did you feel there was something about what the business was doing, that the business's mission itself was worthwhile, or just that you were going to do it in a way which was worthwhile?
The business's mission was good, but it was incidental, really. It was more of a, we thought of it as a lab. It was a lab business, but we thought of the situation as a laboratory, really. Because here we had this thing, small, we had customers. We had, some loyal employees who were like a bit disheartened, very small, so it was not on nobody's radar. We weren't going to get into any big trouble. It was a perfect little lab, actually. We said, well, let's really play with this and see if we can do things differently.
So this is an interesting point for some of the people who may be listening, that there's a that I've encountered being in business myself, the tendency sometimes to feel, well, I've got to be in a business which is morally or ethically or somehow targeted at a social good. I've got to be in the organic recycled moccasin business, in order to do something worthwhile, or have to, a social product. But in this case, you're positing that you can more or less be in any business that's not doing bad, and the process itself can be generating good.
I think that's true. I mean, we were very comfortable with the business that this was in. It's healthcare, it's doing good things for people. So it wasn't, but we didn't pick it for that reason. We picked it originally because it was there and somebody needed help. And, and then we were stuck in it or could have decided to bail and forget it. And we said, okay, let's this it's worth working with. And the fact that it was that, we weren't making, arms, obviously that would not have been acceptable. The fact we were making healthcare products was good, but we didn't choose it because it was, especially in that area.
Now, in any setting, much less business, the laboratory doesn't always work the way you'd like it to work. So I'm sure that within this, what sounds like a very lovely little world of doing good and doing it nicely, there were difficulties, there were conflicts, there were pain in the butt people, there were, all kinds of things. Let's talk a little bit about some of the trauma that's gone along with being in this environment.
Sure. Conflicts between people, I'd say, were the toughest. Misunderstandings between staff, hiring people who you subsequently figure just aren't going to fit and having to fire them. That's probably the toughest, actually. As far as the process that we went through as figuring what we could become, that actually was not that had very little conflict in it. But it would, yeah, it was, people who were, strong-headed or wrong-headed about their view of how things should be done. That has probably been the biggest cause of conflict. And the places where I've actually had to step in and say, no, that's not going to work. That approach isn't going to work. And if you want to work that way, you need to be working somewhere else. We've had to do that a few times over the years. I think we got much better at it because we know more about the kind of people who can work in our environment.
Now, much as I know, Michael, you're a perfect person. Tell me about where you have had personal walls. I mean, things that you have a hard time that bring out the worst in you that you have to relate to.
Well, I like to think of myself as being reasonable and accommodating, and sometimes it's been pointed out to me that I'm not. And I can be quite stubborn about something that I think is really important and may or may not be, but and because I've led the company forward, you know, I have position authority, basically, right? And so there have been some occasions, particularly as we've grown, actually, and we've had strong people coming in who've challenged me in ways that at first I'm kind of going, what? No. But then they've challenged me further, and I really have appreciated after the fact, because, you know, I've learned to look at what I was proposing or pushing for or something as being actually not helpful. So I think probably that's the main way, is that when people have sort of pushed my buttons and then pressed me, you know, challenged me on things that I've thought that were absolutely had to be right, that's, I think, the biggest place, actually.
In what areas have you had to really change or evolve or improve from, you know, where you were at the beginning?
Letting go, I think, you know, which is delegating thoroughly, you know, not worrying, you know, the way something, it's fine if something's done in a completely different way than I would see that it be done. And that's a hard thing to let go of sometimes, you know, because you want it to be shaped in a particular way, you want it to look a particular way, you want it to feel a particular way, and it's kind of like, you know, it's your garden, you know, kind of thing. And somebody suddenly is planting plants that you kind of didn't think were going to fit. And lo and behold, actually, miraculously, almost always they do. And that's the big lesson for me.
Have you ever had either a colleague or an employee or, you know, someone in your business world who has caught you at a moment where their feedback to you has helped you understand something about yourself and how to evolve? And I say this, I'm thinking of a person who worked for me as an assistant some years ago in business, and who one day came into my office and had a little sign. Said, I'd like to be able to hang this on the inside of your door at occasional moments. And I said, what does it say on it? It said, Marty Meltdown. That was enormously helpful to have somebody willing to kind of share that with me.
Yeah, I have, and I'm trying to think of specific instances. I think, you know, people tease me about being, you know, I'm pretty detail-oriented, and actually our whole business has to be, you know, the nature of the business, but also our whole environment and our building is gorgeous and so on and so forth. And I, you know, I like pictures to be hung straight on walls, for example. And so people will tip them a little bit to the side just to irritate me and that kind of stuff. So I don't know that I can think of more profound examples, but those are little tweaks that happen quite regularly.
Yeah. Having been in your office, I do want to say that the way you have worked with space also speaks to me of things that I know were very, very important to the Vidyadhara and very important in the Shambhala tradition. Did you overtly bring that into your work? Is that you, or is that just you happened to hire a great designer?
That was me. I was very fortunate that I had somebody working with me who thought that way naturally. And as somebody who's worked with me now for 18 years, actually, and when she first came in, and we had a board meeting, you know, this is in the early 90s, and she set it up, and it was like, oh my God, she gets how to set up space. Fabulous, right? Just the coffee cups and, you know, the whole thing, it was like perfect. So she worked with me on this building project, and then we had professional designers who translated that into how do you actually do it, right? But the idea was very much for me, because I wanted to, you know, as I learned from Rinpoche, the environment affects people's state of mind, and it affects the way that they work and the way that they think and their sense of freedom and so forth. So I wanted the environment to be really pristine, and we paid a lot of attention to it, and people love it. It actually really works. People love working in that building because it's, you know, the light and the space and so on and so forth.
And it's particularly interesting to me because it's a manufacturing space.
Yeah.
You actually make stuff there, and you run conventional offices, yet it doesn't feel like that. And as you know, Michael, I've actually brought people from my business, much that it helped, to your office so you could tour them around and show them what you did.
Okay, so that comes from, I think this actually fundamentally has to do with, if I connect this back to my understanding from Rinpoche and Dharma practice, has to do with service. A lot of people, when we describe our building, are surprised that we chose where we were going to put the public space, which is a cafe space, an open meeting space. We chose that in the location, because we built the building from scratch, as you know. We chose that to be in the best spot for sun and light that was possible on the lot. And people come in and they say, you did what? Why didn't, you know, what about the warehouse? And, well, we got the warehouse and the manufacturing. It's all fine. But the point was service, so that it would be a place where people really wanted to be, right? And so I think it comes from that. I know a lot of offices, and I know people who've quit their jobs because they couldn't hack the environment that they were in. It's just so depressing, right? So why make a place depressing when you have a choice not? And some people say, well, it costs more. Well, yeah, it costs a little bit more, but relative to the overall cost of our business, you know, facility costs are, I don't know, 5% of our revenue. So maybe they're 5% and they could be 4.7%. I mean, hello. It really seemed to be important as far as creating a space in which staff can really feel comfortable.
This concludes part one of my conversation with Michael Scott. Tune in next time for the conclusion. Support for Chronicles Radio comes from our listening audience. To contribute, go to chroniclesradio.com and click on Support This Work.